Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And a happy Tuesday or Wednesday, whenever you guys are listening to this. We're recording on Tuesday, the 13th of December, 2022. We just finished watching Alabama take care of business against Memphis at home in a pretty tough game. Memphis looked pretty tough. We're not going to jump into that. We'll jump into the big USC stuff first. So, as always, this is Chase, joined by Nick. Nick, how you been?
Been awesome, Chase. Great to have another Heisman Trophy back in LA.
That is correct. So it's been a while. I got used to, you know, during the early 2000s, I got used to these things happening all the time. When we won, what, we won three in a 4 year span, right? Gosh, 2002, 2004.
That's right. It was
2005.
Carson.
A year off, then Matt Leinart in 2004. The year off was when the Oklahoma quarterback won it.
Jason White. Yep.
Jason White. And then we played him next year, Matt winning it. And then Reggie Bush winning in 2005. So that was an exciting time, obviously. Maybe we're heading into another exciting time. We'll have to see. Caleb Williams wins it as a sophomore, which is, you know, just incredibly impressive. You know, it was, I thought he delivered a tremendous speech. The finalists were, it was an interesting group of finalists because essentially they were like the key players on the most prominent players on each of the, teams invited to a college football playoff, with the exception of Michigan, who their candidate, was hurt. So I think I'm not as huge of a fan of it, kind of the Heisman being so focused on, you know, a good player on a winning team. But look, it is what it is. That's what the Heisman has been forever. And you know, these days, all the finalists were quarterbacks, and the quarterback's the most important position on the field. And I think it's tough to argue that any quarterback had a bigger impact on his team than Caleb Williams.
Yeah, I totally agree, Chase. Just out of curiosity, so who would your top three have been this year?
Oh, gosh. I mean, here's where we get the problem, because – I don't even, I don't know. I don't know if I'm even the right person to even trust. I mean, I, you talked to me 10 years ago, I would have given you a really great answer to that question. I don't think I trust myself anymore to answer questions like that. I don't think the list was quote unquote wrong. I think all the players have their, merits to them. Do I think that, like, that Stetson Bennett is really one of the top four players in the country? No. But, you know, he's got his arguments. You know, CJ Stroud is a terrific quarterback. I don't think he makes the impact on the field that Caleb Williams does at this level. Maybe the next level he'll be better than, you know, he'll be the best of this crop, you know, because the NFL game is just a different game than the in the college game. Actually, I was going to address that. Well, maybe I'll address that later a little bit, because I had some interesting thoughts about that, or at least I think they're interesting. So I don't really have an issue, let's say, with, you know, I don't really have a huge issue with Stroud making it, and I don't really have an issue with Max Duggan making it. I think he probably deserved to make it, considering how, you know, the results he produced on the field. But if I was doing the ballot, that'd be interesting, right? Because I'd have to go and I'd really start thinking about who were some of the other players, potentially defensive players that that impact games. So what would your top three be?
I would have gone, so I would have had Caleb one. I kind of view it as like, how does your team look without you too?
Yeah.
So I would consider that, and I would consider like how they look if you're injured too. So I probably would have had Caleb one, and then Penix from Washington two, and probably Bryce Young three. And just because, you know, Alabama without Bryce Young was a complete disaster. like in that Jalen Milroe game, they really fell off. In that Tennessee game, like he was the only reason that game was close. Like just watching it, his scrambling ability. He definitely doesn't have the stats that some of these other guys do. And I would have probably gone with Hooker ahead of him, except for like Tennessee with Joe Milton still looked, you know, pretty solid in that week after they lost. So, yeah, but like, I think Caleb is kind of the clear guy, right? Like 4-8, you know, elevating USC to an 11 one season, all the touchdowns, passing, rushing, and you know, all the sacks he evaded, right, just with his legs and the lack of interceptions, you know, they definitely seem to get the choice right.
Yeah, and I would not disagree with any of your thoughts there on those guys that you mentioned. I think it is interesting. You mentioned three other players, and all three of them were also quarterbacks. And that really just goes to show, you know, this modern style of football, and unfortunately, we lost Mike Leach, I guess it was today, technically. He had a massive heart attack over the weekend. And, you know, other people will be paying tribute to him. He's obviously a huge part of my viewership of college football, really going back to even before Oklahoma. I think when he was at Kentucky and they had some crazy offenses with Tim Couch. Mm-hmm. But the influence that he and some other people had on the game over the last, you know, really quarter century have changed the nature of college football, where it is such a quarterback centric game. And I don't think that's why, you know, it's amazing what kind of Georgia's done with Stetson Bennett, because he's not like a one man show quarterback. Now he can do it. He can get it done. He can do all the things they need to do. But if they're able to win it with him, you know, again this year, I think it really should just how strong of a program that is, because for the vast majority of games, you know, over 90% of the games are being determined by which quarterback had the best game, essentially. And maybe 90% is too much, but it is really today's college football game is, and the NFL largely too, what quarterback had the better game, and then you can figure out who won the game.
Yeah, I think just on the Georgia thing, it kind of feels like we're living through, like, you know, 2012, 2013 Alabama right now, like with Stetson Bennett being the A.J. McCarron character, right? A.J. McCarron won two titles at Bama, you know, and was not that talented, right? He was the game manager type. Stetson Bennett, exact same way. And, you know, Kirby Smart was the defensive coordinator on those Alabama teams, right? So he's kind of structuring his team, you know, to resemble those Alabama teams. And if they win it this year, it kind of gets interesting in the, you know, hierarchy of college football, right? Because I think you got to put Georgia ahead of Alabama. And it does make you think, like, with the drop off in Alabama's defenses since Kirby Smart's left, like, how many of those Bama titles does Nick Saban win if Kirby Smart's not his DC? Right.
Oh, this was the issue Pete Carroll ran into when he ran off Tim or Norm Chow. I mean, at the time it was a huge point of contention. And, you know, Pete had good years after that. Obviously, 2005, we went undefeated before losing the national title game. And 2008, we were undefeated except for one slip up, which cost us the national title appearance. 2006, we would have been there and we lost it, this terrible loss in the season to UCLA, and we just couldn't make it. So, and the offense was never, I mean, the offense of 2005 with all those starters returning was absolutely dynamite, but it was never really the same as it had been under Norm Chow. And I think, you know, I think that's what Alabama's kind of finding here is, like, they had built such a monster of a dynastic program that they could out talent so many teams, and then they would start getting quarterbacks like, you know, Bryce Young, that could, you know, just dominate on the field as well. So the defense wasn't quite as important, but it opened the door to them losing games all of a sudden, which in the past they would not have lost. So, yeah. And, you know, I remember going back 20 plus years seeing this graphic in, I think it was USA Today, it's really dating myself, talking about the record of some of these legendary coaches, guys like Paterno and Bobby Bowden, after they turned, and the year, I think it was, was, I think it was 72 years old, and Saban is going to turn 72 next October. Now, he's a very young looking guy. He's a young 72.
Yeah.
But you know, age is age. And I think it's sometimes at some point it does catch up with you. And I know he's got a lot of people helping him out there, but yeah, still, I think it's going to be an issue. And you can't argue with like facts about their defense. It just has not been the same. And it seems like it's kind of getting worse.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it just goes to show how good Kirby Smart is, right? Like, he's probably the best coordinator of at least the last, what, 20 years, maybe. You know, he's up there with Norm Chow. Like, his defenses at Alabama were unbelievable, that they were so good and so dominant. And then, you know, goes to Georgia, like, immediately, you know, recruits on Alabama's level and upgrades that roster. And, you know, even before he won it last year, those Georgia teams were really freaking good too, right? So,
yeah.
And he's eventually going to run into the same issues probably that, you know, Saban's having now. But, you know, I think if you're taking any coach in college football to start a program with, it's hard to argue with Smart right now.
No, it is hard to argue with him, although you would wonder how many, you know, he's a perfect fit at Georgia. There's a ton of talent down there. Could you, like, transpose that to Nebraska? I don't think so. I mean, he'd have a sterling defense there, but I don't think
– yeah.
I think his offense would catch up with him with the problems. Maybe the Big Ten West, it wouldn't matter as much. You know, I wonder, too, now, you know, if will Brian Kelly, year two, kind of start to more kind of smooth things out at LSU? Will they be able to rise to the level of what Alabama and Georgia have done? And then there's the Tennessee thing. You know, who knows? Maybe they're legit. I don't know. I think a team more reliant strictly on offense is going to be tougher. I mean, but that's USC too. Tennessee is going to have an issue building a strong defense, I think, just from a talent perspective, because they're not the state of Tennessee is not as rich in talent as Georgia. I mean, you know, they're very close to each other, but it does make a difference. All right. So let's talk a little bit, I guess, about, you know, the transfer portal's opened up and guys are jumping in, and right away there's this huge discussion about name and image and likeness. It seems like every program is complaining, with the exception of like a handful, are complaining that they don't have a strong NIL program. Why don't we go to you first? What are your thoughts on NIL? What are your thoughts on some of the comments that have been made, where SC stands, all that stuff?
Yeah, so I think it's hard I guess it's easy for any fan, if they lose a recruit to another school, to blame it on NIL. But I also completely empathize with the position that, oh, look at all these recruits that Miami's getting and Florida's getting and A&M got last year, right? And, you know, those programs, they have 100% agreement between, you know, their boosters and their coach and their administration, whether, you know, those agreements or that agreement's formalized or not. Like, they are in it to win it. They don't care. They want the NCAA to go after them. Their boosters are all setting up the shell corporations and paying players. And I think it's great. Like, I, you know, having been around, like, players who, you know, come from broken families and don't have anything, I think it's fantastic that they're getting as much money as they can. I do realize that what they're doing is against NCAA rules. I just don't think the NCAA has any enforcement power over it. So I definitely think it's here to stay. I applaud all the players, you know, getting as much as they can. And I think it's a really arrogant thing to say, like, oh, you know, why would this kid, like, you know, take $1 million from Florida when he could be coached by Lincoln Riley and, you know, be the number one pick in the draft, right? Like, you've seen those takes, right? And it just, it's just so incredible. Like, the security of having $1 million now for a lot of these kids is completely life-changing. And, you know, what if they flame out at USC? Like, you know, like Spencer Rattler, right? Like, Lincoln would kick him to the curb if they weren't good, right? And then you got nothing.
Yeah. Well, and it was that one person made the comment that, you know, they're not going to be motivated to play anymore if they're making $1 million or motivated to try.
Right. Yeah.
And I said, well, I mean, are we going to apply that to what about every single 19-year-old that enters the NBA draft or 18-year-olds that are entering the Major League Baseball draft and are taking, you know, they get these huge signing bonuses and then they're off to the minor and that baseball's extreme, right? They're off to the minors. Right. And then it's like, all they have is their, all they have is their signing bonus and they're getting paid peanuts. You know, what I think it's interesting, what I was going to say, is you're going to have to make decisions. You know, coaches like Lincoln Riley are going to have to make decisions about, you know, I think they probably know, look, we can probably get an unsigned player, some sort of NIL deal here and there as we think is appropriate. I'm sure that happens all the time, even at schools that are like, quote unquote, you know, like Miami and, you know, Florida being so obvious about it. But then you have to be very careful with how you allocate that money. And I do kind of like, for the most part, I think what they're doing, because I think you don't want to get caught in a situation where you're throwing a lot of money at a high school player that you're just not quite sure about. Because then that money is, you know, it's just not as good of a gamble with your money, right? So SC has, I think, 19 high school players, no, 17 high school players committed. I think a couple of them actually might drop off. We might gain a couple or so, you know, I'm guessing we'll be right around there. I mean, I'm wondering in the future if it'll be even lower, even though I'm assuming there'll be a major personnel turnover. I think they're going to try to target more, obviously, transfers. We picked up this Jamil Muhammad from Georgia State, he's an interesting guy. Look, he's in his own way like a developing prospect, because even though he's older, he was a high school quarterback and he entered college as a quarterback for Vanderbilt. And he kind of just grew naturally. And, you know, he's about 250 pound guy that can play on the line and maybe can play a little bit, you know, standing up as well. We have other offers out there, but, you know, I think, and for my buck, I think sometimes that's like a better use of your dough. If you need to put, you know, if you have limited resources, then maybe a high school kid who's, you know, it's like the same height, but maybe 30 pounds lighter and needs to grow into his body. And they're not quite sure how he's going to develop, you know, and Muhammad's already played against, you know, FBS schools. So he knows what it's like to play on that, at that level. So I'm curious how that goes in the future, how we decide to do that. No, you know, just from like a rankings perspective, I think SC's got like, they've got five guys committed who are ranked in like the top 120 or so. And that includes like Tackett Curtis from Louisiana, who I'd call those guys like the core high school recruits. And then a couple guys ranked near 200. And then, you know, after that, so like lower ranked recruits. Now some of that is like we're recruiting linemen, and these days linemen are kind of downgraded in some of the national rankings, much more so than 10 years ago. I think, you know, you have to be, if you're going to allocate funds to some of these kids that are ranked outside of the top 120, you got to just be careful with doing that. And anyway, that's just my observation. Oh, the other thing I was going to say was, there's going to be situations that are going to start, because we've started to see some pretty high dollar numbers being thrown around here. Now, I don't know if you can believe them, but I think there was the recruit that was deciding between Ohio State and Georgia. And what was do you remember the rumored number there?
Yeah, it was a 5-star kid, and allegedly Georgia offered him like 1.8 a year with a $400,000 signing bonus, and Ohio State offered him like 800 grand, and their fans were like lose their mind saying our NIL is not competitive, basically.
Right. So not for necessarily for a kid like at that level, but there are going to be, especially I think quarterbacks, there are going to be quarterbacks who are faced the decision whether or not to enter the NFL draft. And if they do enter the draft, they're probably not looking at top three round projections. So if you're top three rounds of the NFL draft, you'll probably sign a contract that's better than the, let's say, minimum scale for rookie, second, third, fourth year player. But once you start to get in fourth round and lower, you're basically kind of like just signing contracts that are like league minimum contracts. And for a rookie, you're starting out for the first year, like $750,000. So if you're a quarterback, there are going to be quarterbacks who are more valuable that for their college team on NIL basis than rolling the dice entering the NFL draft where they might only go fifth, sixth round. Which is interesting because there's only going to be X number of quarterbacks taken in the draft anyway. And there's certainly only going to be X number that are going to go in the top four rounds. So you could see that happening with running backs for sure. Also, that's going to be an interesting trend, right? Watching that, if you have a running back thinking, okay, I can, you know, maybe I'll get drafted, but even if I get drafted, am I going to have a better, is the opportunity to make more NIL money by staying here next year better? So I'm going to be curious how these situations come up. Now, the kids going first round, that's not going to be an issue because you're going to get guaranteed money. It's going to be completely life-changing. So those are not the ones I'm talking about. And I'm not talking about Caleb Williams because Caleb Williams is going to be a first, you know, top of first round pick. But I'm talking about there are going to be quarterbacks that, you know, are really great college prospects or, really great college players that are not super great NFL prospects. They might still be drafted, but they're not necessarily – going to project to, you know, do, you know, top three, top four rounds. So it's something certainly to keep an eye on. And, you know, we're going to see it in basketball too, quite frankly.
Because... So I think a great example of your quarterback thing is Devin Leary from NC State. So he just finished his fourth year. He's got the COVID year left and he got injured like midway through this season, but his junior year, he threw 35 touchdowns and five picks and for 3,400 yards at 66%. And he just entered the portal. So like, that's the kind of kid that like, you're probably going to see, you know, like the LSUs of the world, like going after, he'll play, you know, for a pretty good team for sure. You know, Brian Kelly already kind of did it with Jaden Daniels, right?
Like, yes.
Not a Caleb Williams level, but like kind of that tier below, still really good and can help your team.
Yes. And if you're going to throw money at a position, throw the money at the quarterback, right? I mean, the quarterback can really make it, you know, a real, I mean, we saw that. What would SC's record have been without Caleb Williams this year? Yeah. So, you know, now maybe we would have had, you know, Jackson Dart, but let's say we didn't have Jackson Dart. Let's say he was hurt. It would have been just, quarterback can make a huge difference. You know, the difference between going 5-7 and 8-4, it's only three wins or losses, but like, that's psychologically a huge, huge difference, right? You know, and it affects all aspects of your program. So, I mean, the quarterback is in some ways almost as important as the head coach, which is really amazing.
One other angle on this too, I'm curious as your thoughts on this is, do you think USC's like lack of, because this has been like a big discussion point, why isn't their high school recruiting ranking better? Do you think that's because the administration is got their hands all over NIL and they're just not competitive with other schools? Or do you think they have, or do you think it's a funding issue? Like they only have a set amount of funds and they're deciding to spend more of that on the transfer portal than other programs are?
I think the answer is all the above. I hate to cop out that way, but I think there is a constraint on funds caused somewhat by, look, if it was a complete free for all and there were no administrative issues and the administration was like supporting, like using NIL as a recruitment tool, I think in that case, it would be absolutely crazy. Cause then you'd have these like crazy corporate sponsorships, right? Which is where SC could really, you know, take advantage. Where SC runs into problems is trying to get money from individual donors who are not corporations, and trying to do it in kind of a somewhat surreptitious way if you're going to do it for recruitment purposes for NIL. So I do think that part of it does create some sort of ceiling on funds or some sort of that being said, I guarantee you, if it was one particular player that we could get an X dollar amount, the funds would be made available for Lincoln Riley to get that guy. I'm sure about that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that Lincoln Riley has a blank check. It means that he has a he has discretion in particular circumstances, and he will have to, you know, use his discretion, you know, selectively. One, you know, it's funny what Miami has done and like Texas A&M has have done. First off, okay, so here's my Monday morning quarterbacking on Texas A&M. I think that what's happened there is they spent way too much money on high school players. And this goes back to kind of my, you know, just going through many years of really top notch recruiting classes for, with Pete Carroll, and then the early Lane Kiffin years. And then later on, we had, you know, Sark brought in some crazy recruiting classes too. But certainly the Pete Carroll early Kiffin recruiting classes, that period from like 2001 to like 2010, there would be players that just did not pan out, at least certainly initially, like you thought they were going to. And I'm just thinking of guys like Devon Kennard, who ended up playing the NFL for like, you know, 10 years. Everson Griffin, who played in the NFL for like 12 years. Those guys took a while to come around, and they were five-star all everything recruits. In the NIL context, if you got owed these guys a lot of money every year, you're right away starting to think like, oh, was this investment wise? Do I have to pay this guy? Am I doing paying him for another year of development? That's where you run into problems, I think, with doing the high school recruiting. So I think in some ways what Lincoln's done is like his strategic, like who do we have that are like the high NFL, high NIL targets, right? Malachi Nelson, who's a quarterback, right? He's a quarterback. So you're going to know pretty well, like, He's not a defensive lineman that's going to take 3 or 4 years to develop. You're going to know pretty quickly whether this guy's got it or he doesn't, you know. Zachariah Branch, he's a receiver. Makai Lemon is a receiver. You have Braylon Shelby, I'm a little, you know, he's an edge rusher, so you're not necessarily going to know for a few years. Tackett Curtis is a stand-up linebacker. I think you're going to know after the end of his first year, unless he gets hurt, whether or not he's got the chops. Now, that doesn't mean he's got to be like starting and making, you know, being the best player on defense by the end of his freshman year, but you're going to kind of get a feel. I mean, even like I remember in 2005, that's when we had brought in Cushing and Malaluga, and I think it was Cushing's father. One of their fathers had passed, so he wasn't playing in the championship against Texas. Like, we could really have used those guys playing a lot more, and they weren't really available for that game against Vince Young. So, but everyone kind of knew that these guys were going to, you know, they were going to be legit and they were going to come through. So my point being, like, you have to be strategic at what positions that you're recruiting. If you're recruiting like Texas A&M, you're recruiting like three different five-star interior defensive linemen, you're not going to know if those guys are like worth it every year. Yeah. It's going to be, you know, so you're going to have to keep paying them more and more money. Whereas I think sometimes, hey, maybe it's harder to get like a really high quality interior defensive lineman on the transfer market, but I think, you know, even if you have to pay a little more, kind of makes sense. So anyway, that's a very long answer to a question that was to a different question.
And just to piggyback on that a little bit, like with these individual guys, like they, Malachi and Makai Lemon, they're high school teammates, and they were both committed to Lincoln Riley at Oklahoma, kind of like before the NIL thing blew up. So I think, you know, they flip to USC, NIL becomes a thing, and then they end up taking, and I think Zach Branch was on it too, that summer visit to A&M. Like, that was clearly a negotiating play to try to get more money out of USC's boosters, right? Because, you know, they committed before the whole thing blew up, and then they wanted, you know, to get that money. So, you know, I doubt they're paying those guys like their full market value, right? Like, if Branch goes down and if Branch announces, oh, I'm taking a bunch of visits to, you know, Georgia, Alabama, I'm sure he could get a better NIL deal than what he currently has, but his brother's also on the team. So he's a relative cost, you know, he's a cost savings relative to, you know, what he could get on the open market. And then you look at Braylon Shelby, he wasn't like an elite recruit when they signed him. He was more of like a low four star that's developed into like a, you know, top 100 recruit because he's gotten better. So I'm sure whatever NIL they promised him when recruiting him, you know, was again like a below market kind of deal, right? And with Tackett Curtis, his final three were USC, Ohio State, and Wisconsin. And if you're throwing Wisconsin in there over LSU, you know, it just kind of shows that NIL is not really his highest priority, or else he would have, you know, thrown probably like Texas A&M and LSU and, you know, maybe Georgia in there as well. So
yeah,
it does seem like he's done a good job, you know, with these guys getting relatively guys at below market rate. And that's what it's all about in what's effectively becoming, you know, a sport where you have a budget, right? And you've got to allocate the budget. And I'm just hopeful that if you do have a five-star that Lincoln wants, right, and George is offering him 2.5, I'm hoping that USC can be competitive with that and not have the administrative restraints, you know, placed on them. And because it is a shock, right, for the everyday USC fan to look at the recruiting class saying, we went 11-1. Why are we number 14? We had top five classes under Clay Helton, right? It's just a different era.
It is a very different era. It's also, I think, people have to get, I think, a little bit adjusted to the idea that California is no longer the, you know, it's no longer really a top three state for recruiting, which is, I mean, it's fallen from like number one to number four very quickly. And, you know, you see that. I think there are, I'm looking right now, there are something like, let's see, eight players in the top 100, composite top 100 from California. You know, that's pretty, for a state that has, you know, 1/8 of the state of the, you know, it's basically 12.5% of the population. And there's only, you know, 8% of the top 100. And then I think the top 200 is increased. There's only 13 in the top 200. You know, if you just purport.
Go ahead. And Texas has 17.
Yeah. And the top 100 or top 200?
Top 100.
Yeah. Yeah. So they have more in the top 100 than we, and California has in the top 200, you know. So, you know, and also California players are heavily weighted toward, I guess it's a big deal now, but it's heavily weighted toward skill positions, especially wide receiver. And to the extent they're defensive players on there, they're mainly cornerbacks. So, you know, it's harder to, you know, you need to fill out your roster with players that are defensive linemen, that are linebackers. Yeah. And since there are zero top 200 linebackers from California, I mean, that's crazy, you know? I mean,
yeah.
I guess there's one, right? There's this Blake Nicholson who's from Manteca in California, but he's going to Florida State. He's like top 200 barely. You know, it's just a whole different era for recruiting a little bit. And look, this was going to happen. The population changes, politics in California, and quite frankly, like hostility toward football. I mean, I think the hostility toward football is kind of coming, you know, closing down, but just as it was kind of closing down, COVID absolutely just smashed it. So, I mean, football in California has been under a steady stream of different attacks, just draining it. So, I mean, maybe it'll rebound over time, but yeah, it's tough. Let's talk just a little bit maybe about who's on the transfer. I mean, I'm going by Gerard's list here. On offense, even though he has a number of candidates, but I think the only one we offered, I mean, I don't think we've even offered an offensive lineman. The only one we offered was Jaheim Bell, who ends up committing to Florida State. He was a South Carolina H-back tight end type. We could definitely use a guy like that. But there are receivers out there like Dorian Singer. We have not offered him. And so right now, I think maybe we might be waiting for like the next like post bowl entrance into the transfer portal on offense. I have a feeling on defense, we've been more aggressive. A whole bunch of offers for various defensive linemen. As I mentioned, the Jamel Muhammad from Georgia State committed. I think we have Josiah Stewart coming on campus from Coastal Carolina. He had like a really big year as a freshman at Coastal Carolina. Good sophomore year, not quite as big of a year. And then there's the there's the Texas A&M defensive tackle who's transferring, but I think he's I'm not sure if we're really a candidate to get him. I know Lincoln went to go visit him, Adelier. And then I know this Keon Bars from Arizona, their defensive tackle entered the portal. And so any thoughts on any of these guys?
Yeah, so Stewart, the Coastal Carolina guy, he posted a top three of Michigan, USC, and LSU. So, you know, at least if you're making the top three, you've contacted the dude and you're interested on some level. So we'll see what happens there.
And based upon what we know from Michigan's NIL, which is apparently has a major, major issues, this may be a LSU-USC thing.
Right, right. You know, that's if NIL is a priority, and for 95% of the kids it is. So,
yeah.
And then the Tune Misi Adelaide guy, you know, he was taking visits to Michigan State and Miami, and I'm not like overly high on him. I mean, he's had 0.5 tackles for loss in 2 years at A&M. So that's kind of more of a star rating thing. And you know, I know that USC has a lot of holes to fill on their in their front seven, but they could probably do better, right? I guess interior defensive linemen are just hard to come by too.
They are hard to come by, and it would be, I mean, I'm not sure if this guy's the answer, but it would be nice if we had, you know, a steady anchor at nose tackle that was like a legit 300-pound guy, and maybe even two of them. But go ahead.
Yeah. So kind of switching gears too, with the offense, you know, you've mentioned the lack of offers. I think that's been notable, right? All the defensive offers and very few offensive offers, especially wide receiver, right? Like you look at Dorian Singer and you look at his stats and what he did. You look at like even Dante Thornton at Oregon, right? 6'4", former top recruit, has some production at Oregon. And it's kind of curious they haven't offered either of those guys. So do you think this is the case of like them looking at the depth chart and saying, you know, even without Addison, we're totally fine with the freshman coming in? Or do you think it's like, you know, we have maybe one spot and we're just going to save that in case a Xavier Worthy or like a Marvin Harrison Jr. jumps into the portal?
I think it's the latter. First off, I don't look, if we, you know, there's some crazy receiver that jumped in, you can't say no, but
yeah,
I will just say that the receiver group for next season is going to be, as it stands, really good. Now I there's some assumptions I'm putting in there. I'm assuming Taj Washington's coming back. I'd be surprised if he didn't, but you know, you start off with him and Mario Williams and Michael Jackson III, who really kind of started to come on this season. You know, you have Brendan Rice there as kind of like, I think, a secondary type guy. Gary Bryant Jr. is still going to be on the team next year. And then you have Kyle Ford. So there's a lot of, like, I think at the top end between, and I guess we haven't even mentioned like CJ Williams from Monterey Day. So I'm curious about him too. But at the top end with Mario Williams, Taj Washington, Michael Jackson III, you know, I'm pretty happy with that. Those three as being your like top three receivers, especially given who you got backing up. But then you have the freshmen they're coming in. I mean, we are two just fantastic receiver prospects. I mean, Branch could be you know, another like DeAnthony Thomas. I mean, he is really spectacular, and Makai Lemon is just a beast. So those guys, I think, are going to be really, really good. So you put them with where we are. You don't want to make, I mean, look, you can always use more receivers, but you don't want to make things overly crowded. I think Lincoln does a good job of spreading the ball around, but you don't want to also, you want to make sure everyone's getting opportunities. I mean, this season, there were times when we couldn't really get Mario Williams the opportunities, or Taj Washington the opportunities, or Michael Jackson III the opportunities, because when he would get it, he really took advantage. So, You know, so I, all that being the one thing I'm more surprised, the thing on offense would be like a tight end. It would really, I think we could really use, and that's like the one offer we made. So now that even a tight end, I should say that Lake McCree, as the season went on, started to look pretty good. So maybe he's a guy, you know, he was only a freshman.
Yeah.
We are going to need a running back, at least one from the portal, maybe two. I'm guessing the running – is it Trayvon Henderson, the Ohio State running back? I think he announced today that he's not going to play in the college football playoff. My assumption is he will hit the portal after the playoff. And I think we're going to target him is my guess. I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think if you're getting the freshman year, Trayvon Henderson, that's a really fantastic player that has like Heisman Trophy finalist potential. He was just really, really good. I think he averaged north of 7 a carry there. And then this year, like, there's been rumblings about him hitting the portal just because he's been super banged up. I think he thinks that the Ohio State doctors like cleared him when he wasn't healthy and his production went down. And, you know, I think there have been some rumblings too about that locker room not really being the best. And it kind of like, yeah, with the way they, you know, they played that Michigan game, it, you know, it's easy to connect the two, but I think that that situation, I think, isn't quite as stable as it's been in previous years. So just kind of like, what do you think of the whole Ryan Day thing? Like, do you think Ryan Day is a good coach? I guess you can start with that.
Well, I think, look, the answer is I think, yes, he's a good coach. Could he build a program from scratch? I don't know about that. But
yeah,
look, there have been other coaches who have inherited programs that were in even stronger position than Ryan Day. Yep. And they were able to really produce for year two, but by the time you got to the third year, it was pretty obvious. It was pretty obvious that the program was going to be in steep decline. And you have not seen that with Ryan Day. Now, obviously that was a really bad loss to Michigan, but they were undefeated going into that game. So he's never, you know, he's only lost 5 games in 4 years at Ohio State.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's for sure true. I guess I'm just looking at it from the perspective of, you know, you had that team with Chase Young, Jeff Okuda, Justin Fields, right? And they, you know, they lost that Clemson team, and Clemson had Trevor Lawrence, but like he was far and away their best player. And it felt like Ohio State had its talent advantage in that game. And then you look at, you know, this year he's got all those upperclassmen offensive linemen. I mean, they're set to lose not only CJ Stroud, but 4 of their offensive linemen, it looks like, assuming Weifler turns pro, which is kind of expected. And their defense wasn't, you know, that great this year. I mean, they were, you know, kind of hit or miss, and they got torched in that Michigan game. So I don't know. I mean, like he was handed a lot by Urban, and I guess I'm just not sold on him yet. Like maybe it's because he hasn't won the big game, but you know, it feels like he's always had superior talent, and you know, he hasn't, you know, always delivered.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, one of the problems is the general perception that the Big Ten outside of Ohio State and Michigan, and I guess to an extent Penn State, has just been so weak, because
right,
he's only lost to Michigan, and he's lost twice, but he's won every other conference game. I think the issue is that he's not as good as Kirby Smart or Nick Saban or potentially even Dabo Sweeney. That's the issue, yep. You know, so maybe not, you know, Lincoln Riley as well. You throw his name in there. but he's kept a program that was turned into like a well-oiled machine. He's kept it going. But he's not, no, I agree with this. He is not as good of a coach as Urban Meyer. And I don't know if he'll ever be as good.
Oh, not close. Yeah.
But that being said, you know, if you switch coaches with that and you like restart the program, it can be, you know, you might all of a sudden you're going to start having problems beating Purdue and stuff like that. So they're just too good right now, I think, to mess with that too much. Now, maybe if recruiting is like turns into like a real serious issue for them over time, then okay, then maybe like, all right, well, something to look at, something to think about.
Yeah, which it has to like a little bit of an extent, right? Like their current recruiting class is number 7, which it is a drop off for them from prior years. They've been like, you know, 2, 3, you know, the last several cycles here. And then 3 of their top 4 commits are wide receivers. So, you know, you kind of wonder about, you know, what does that roster look like, you know, once if recruiting isn't top 2 or 3 for them kind of year in, year out, like, can they get it done? So I'm really curious to see how we play these guys once we get to the Big Ten, because, you know, this recruiting class, this 2023 class, you know, this will be kind of the foundation of our first Big Ten year, right? There'll be sophomores. It'll be certainly a big part of that. So, yeah, I mean, I guess we'll get these questions answered in a couple of years here, but just definitely curious to see how it plays out.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's, before we take up too much time, let's talk a little basketball. Okay, so USC beat Fullerton after you start off dynamite and then kind of looked a little ugly, got back into it and kind of held them off, maintained like a 10-point lead for most part, won the game. Not a great look. They play Long Beach State tomorrow, which is Wednesday. The interesting thing has been the emergence of Kobe Johnson. Trey White had a good game as well, but those two guys were the guys scoring double figures. Conversely, Boogie Ellis comes out of just the, you know, goes from averaging 18 points a game for the season to like 6 points a game these last 3 games. Ice cold from outside. He, Andrew Peterson, and Dixon Waters, I think 3 for 24 in the last 2 games combined from 3, which is, you know, that's a killer. I mean, it's hard to win games. It's even hard to win any games with those kind of numbers. You know, maybe they shake out of it. The team is like winning and steadily falling in KenPom. The defense has actually played very well. I do think that, you know, some of the KenPom numbers are a little bit screwed up, I think. I mean, he has our offense rated 106, which, you know, is very well maybe legit. But he has our defense rated 50th, even though we're 18th in effective field goal percentage defense. And we played a decently tough schedule. You know, we don't turn a lot of teams over a ton, but we're actually not that far below the median for turnovers. Our rebounding is not as strong. But I think our defense is actually better than 50th in the country. I think it's more like top 30-ish. The problem is the offense has just been terrible. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm left scratching my head. I watch all these other teams play. Watched Arizona State, you know, eke it out against Creighton yesterday with a team of essentially all transfers. And our team is like no transfers from them. I'm wondering if there is too much of a sense of complacency on the team. I mean, there's definitely good aspects. Josh Morgan's had a tremendous season. We're 8th in the country in block rate. You know, we're 5th in the country in 2-point field goal percentage defense. So there's a lot of really good things there, but like we're not shooting. There's like a lot of stagnation on offense. Like we're still working through things on our sets and things like that. So I don't know. What do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, the offense is hard to watch, right? They just, they can't make any threes. At the end of the day, that's kind of what it is, right? Like they're below 31% from 3. And, you know, if they got that up into the 36, 37% range, I think these offensive stats would look a lot different, right?
Yeah. The other thing is offensive rebounding too. We should mention that.
Yeah. Yeah, we're just bad on the glass. Like we don't defensive rebound. We don't offensive rebounds. It's just bad. A lot of it's a lack of size, but if you're going to play small lineups like that, and you're going to give up rebounding, to the extent that we do, you got to make more shots, right?
Is it fair to even say really lack of size? I mean, I think we're 7th in the country in average height.
Are we really?
That's amazing. Well, because our shortest starter is the shortest guy in our rotations are Boogie Ellis and Malik Thomas. Nobody else who even gets on the court is below 6'5". And you know, like, yeah, we don't have a true 4 out there most of the time, but you know, Drew Peterson 6'9". you know, whatever position you think he's playing. Kobe, I think, is a tall, I think he's actually plays taller than 6'6 in some ways. Yeah. You know, Reese has not been playing up to 6'5 because I think he's still, like, I think that hernia situation is still bothering him. But Trey White does. Trey White plays tall, you know. So Kejani Wright has not rebounded great. I think he's actually defended pretty well. He hasn't rebounded great. Harrison Horner obviously hasn't rebounded great. But I don't think it's height. I think it's, I think there's like a little bit of a, there's like a little bit of an intensity issue.
Yeah, I mean, on the Kejani Wright thing, I mean, you can just look at the stats, right? Like, his defensive rebounding rate is less than half of what Trey White's defensive rebounding rate is, and he's 2 inches taller and plays the five, right? Like, that's a problem. I think he's, you know, in the right position a lot of the time. He's just not a super long guy, and he doesn't have a great vertical, right? So he kind of has to, like, positionally rebound and with those effort plays, kind of like, you know, Jalen Williams at Arkansas. Like, he was a great positional rebounder. And if you remember from the tournament last year, that really saved Arkansas in several of those games. It was how just kind of smart he was and getting himself in the right spot. But yeah, I mean, Dixon Waters below, you know, 9% rebounding rate, defensive rebounding rate. And Morgan at 15 seems low, but he has to contest so many shots. So I don't think, like, it's really an effort thing with him. Like, he plays really hard. I don't know if there's a great answer. I mean, Peterson's been okay on the glass, but the offense rebounding is bad too, right? Like, it's not just defensive.
Yeah, the offensive rebound in some ways is worse.
It's at least as bad.
We're defensive rebounding, we're 237th in the country. Offensive rebounder, we're 244th in the country. So we're bad at both ends on rebounding. I do, like, Kejani Wright, I think some of that is, like, he's, whenever he goes in the game, because he goes into the five, other teams seem to immediately pass the ball to whoever he's guarding, and the guy will shoot it. So I think he's not necessarily always in a position to get the rebound, but I don't want to make excuses because I'm not sure that's the case 100% of the time. But, like, you know, we don't have, like, any, like, super great rebounders, and we don't really have a true four. It shouldn't be as bad as it is, though, because between Peterson, Kobe, and Trey White, you know, they defensive rebound pretty well. You'd think that'd be enough, but maybe they're not on the court enough. Boogie's been really bad, like, offensive rebounding has one on the season. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. some of these numbers. I think there's just got to be a little bit. I think there's got to be, like, more intensity put into these guys. I don't know if sometimes the rotations kind of mess with us a little bit. Like, we start off so strong against Fullerton, and then, you know, then we started to rotate players and we kind of, like, got out of it. I get that we need to get guys minutes, but I don't know. Maybe it's time to start talking about reducing the rotation a little bit. Okay. So you want to talk about our little offline bet here? Why don't you describe it?
Yeah. So we were talking about just kind of big man rotation a little bit, what we can do to kind of, like, help in the minutes that, you know, we have to spell Morgan. It's kind of like that's at least how I viewed it. So we've got two sides here. Andy seems to be going kind of more towards my side. Doesn't mean it's correct, but he's starting to play Niagu more over Hornery. And Chase has been on team Hornery here, and I've been on team Niagu. I think the numbers...
Before we get into it, can we just stipulate this is a false choice, that he doesn't need to play either of these guys?
Yeah, for sure. So,
yep. Okay. However, let's go to the debate.
Yep. So do you want to present your case for Hornery? I can just
sure.
Let you lay it
look,
out.
So, okay. Yeah. So here's I think if you're, for some reason, find yourself, first off, it's a little bit of an odd situation, right? Because they definitely play different positions. Hornery is almost always in the game at the four. Now, he did play the five a little bit against, was it, I think it might have been against Oregon State when we were playing, like, a zone. which to me, by the way, was absolutely crazy to have him in the back of the zone. But he was there for the most part. When he's in the game, he's playing the four. Niagu plays only the five, right? So there's no question that, you know, what he's in the game doing. So I'm trying to give him a little Niagu, a little, I mean, I guess, let me just talk about advocacy for Harrison. When he's in the game, he seems to pass the ball to the right person. He understands how the offense works. You know, guys tend to, you know, be spaced properly. And you kind of see that in reflected, not in his own personal numbers, but in just like the team numbers. And I think it's true on defense as well. He tends to be in the right place on defense. So, you know, for the season, he hasn't played a ton, but he's played about 150 possessions on offense and 150 on defense. And when he's in the game, we're slightly below average on offensive points per possession, but his, you know, it's actually better than when Boogie's in the game. And our defense is actually, I mean, he's better. He's got better on-court, off-court numbers than Boogie Ellis, Harrison does. And
that's amazing.
And now you look at his individual numbers, they're not good. I mean, in fact, I'm not sure there any of them are good at all. But I think it just the fact that he seems to like know where to be on the court, he just like generally helps the team. He doesn't take a lot of one good thing he does not take a lot of bad shots. I will give him credit for that. So he can't really, you know, he can't defend the rim at all. That's not what he's out there to do. He's not shooting very well and he's not hitting his threes, but at least he seems to understand the spacing, where to be on the court. Niagu, you know, I watched, you know, with curiosity as he started to get in a little bit and was hoping for more here and there. The last he was put in at the end of the or in the second half of the Fullerton game when we had built up a decent lead. And I think the other team immediately went on a 7-0 run. And he really, all he did for those, like whatever, 90 seconds he was on the court while the other team was scoring constantly, was run up and down the court. I mean, I don't think he literally did anything but like run from like free throw line to free throw line. He let a guy go right to the basket and shoot a layup. I mean, not only did he like not, you know, almost foul him, I mean, he wasn't even close to the rim, just totally out of position. I don't think Niagu understands where he's supposed to be, what he's supposed to be doing. He's not comfortable out there at this stage. And it's not clear to me he'll ever be comfortable out there. And I will say this is reflected in the on-court, off-the-court numbers for Niagu, which is a much smaller sample size. I concede only 46 offensive possessions, 45 defense possessions. The defense has not been terrible when he's out there. It's actually very close to when Harrison Hornery's out there. Not quite as good, but about the same. The offense has been absolutely terrible when he's out there. We're averaging 0.65 points per possession. Now, some of that is he's been out there with just the kind of B team at the end of games when we're just playing terrible, but not always. I mean, he's been in there with some starters as well, and that's a really, really, really bad number. So here's my argument.
Yeah, that was good. So, okay, here's my case. I'll respond to a few of your points. And again, like, you know, neither have to play, right? But just for the sake of argument. So he does have, and again, limited sample size. He does have the best defensive rebounding rate on the team. We've really struggled in defensive rebounding. I thought he looked a little bit more comfortable against Fullerton, actually, than against Mount St. Mary's. I thought that Mount St. Mary's game, he was just really atrocious. And you know, against Fullerton, he did have two rebounds in 8 minutes. He had one block where he like did, you know, was in the right position and like used his length. He has a little more length than Hornery at the rim for sure. And, you know, that's why he can play the five and Hornery can't. And I think that's the other kind of point here, right? Is if you're using these guys as like a way to spell Morgan, I think Niagu fits more of that true five role that you can spell Morgan with more than Hornery, who's more of a four. So Morgan, he can't play the full 40, right? I think Kajani Wright is more of a natural four than five. I know he's been used as, you know, at the five. you know, just out of necessity this year. But I think Niagu maybe can give you a few minutes there, potentially, until Vince comes back. Whereas I don't really see, you know, a case for putting Hornery in at the four over our other options at the four, like Peterson, maybe Kajani Wright, right? You know, if you want to go small and play like Kobe Johnson there, right, you can do that. Besides that, there's just the case that Hornery's in year two, Niagu is a 7-footer in year one. You know, as he gets more acclimated, maybe he gets better and can develop some like Nick Rakosevich skills and such. But I think there's more like quote unquote untapped potential there than you have in Hornery, who I think is more, you know, you're seeing kind of what you get with him. And, you know, his shooting percentage, you know, 38.4% true shooting percentage for Hornery on the season is kind of not great, considering he's not a very good defender and he's billed as like a stretch four. So there's my, you know, there's my counter. And I do think, like, to an extent, in the Niagu on-court, off-court numbers, they are, you know, undoubtedly terrible. But some of that is because he's, you know, like you said, the lineups he's in with are kind of the B team lineups, and he's playing without Josh Morgan on the floor, who's been very good defensively and pretty solid offensively as well.
What do you think about the turnover rate for Niagu?
I mean, what's not to like, right? 0% assist rate and 49% turnover rate. Just pretty elite.
Just so people understand. But people understand the idea of the turnover rate is if the possession ends with you having the ball, what percentage of possessions ending with you having the ball result in a turnover? And for him, the answer is about half. So it's equally likely. There's a 0% chance he's going to give an assist. So it's equally likely he'll get a shot up or turn it over. Those are the numbers. 0% chance.
And somehow he personally only has two turnovers on the year, right? So that's
well, because he has two shots.
Right.
He has two shots, really two turnovers, bad. Zero assists. I mean, it's pretty simple math there.
There it is.
All right. I don't know. Okay, it's getting late. Anything else before we break for the I don't know. We're talking about Long Beach State. They're not terrible. I know they didn't. They lost to Sacramento State over the weekend. That's not good. Let's talk just a little bit about, I know we're beating this horse to death, but some of the things we've seen over the weekend, you know, Bama beat Houston at Houston.
Yeah.
Game you went to. We buried that one. We should talk, Houston, number one team in the country. Then won a home game tonight against Memphis. We should say the crowd in Houston was really lively.
Oh yeah, it was great. And it was awesome. They had the mayor was there. Jalen Green and KJ Martin were there. Hakeem Olajuwon was there. Andre Johnson was there. They kind of had all the Houston quote unquote celebrities showed up for that one. So it was awesome. They had shirts on all the seats for the crowd and got super into it, and they broke an attendance record. So Tillman Fertitta was there, the Rockets owner, and awesome environment. They end up getting up 15 points in the second half and just couldn't score. And Bama, you know, they've got a lot of length and they defend well and they rebounded and they kind of just piece by piece, you know, bit by bit, got back into it, and give them all the credit in the world. I mean, that was a really, really good performance by them, and it kind of underscored Houston's weakness, which is just half court offense. You know, at certain times they don't have elite shooting, and it can get tough when you're in games like that. But you know, hats off to Bama and Nato. It's really, really impressive win for them.
And I think we're talking about Bama, kind of like the interesting thing to me is watching a team that had been so guard heavy, and we assumed they'd be guard heavy again this year because Quinterly came back. Namari Burnett was coming back off an injury. He missed a year. Now he's back out of injury again. I guess he broke his wrist.
Yeah.
Mark Sears was coming in from Ohio, and then Jaden Bradley was coming in as a really high ranked freshman. So you have four like potential point guards competing for time there. And really those guys have like, in the past, I think Oates would have, you know, played those guys, the one, two, and three, maybe even four guards, but not this year because Brandon Miller is kind of firmly entrenched at the freshman. Brandon Miller is firmly entrenched at the three. He's 6'9". And then this other freshman, Noah Clowney, who's been really fantastic.
Yes.
He's getting a lot of time really at the four. So they're now a tall team. They're not a small little team that runs around like crazy. I mean, for, you know, sometimes they'll go a little small, I guess, and play like Darius Miles at the three. But for the most part, you're going to get, or they'll get, sometimes they'll play Rylan Griffin too, was a big time recruit as well. But for the most part, you're seeing a lot of like Miller, Clowney, maybe Gurley, maybe Bediako, maybe Pringle. So they're a big team.
Yeah, no, for sure. And one thing that did really change that game too, is in the second half, Jaden Bradley, the freshman who, he's highly touted, but he wasn't like considered an elite recruit that like Brandon Miller was per se. You know, he just was able to penetrate and make all the right decisions. So he was kicking it out to the wings and you know, took care of the ball for the most part. And even on the, you know, plays where Bama missed their threes, like Bradley was beating his man off the dribble and getting his teammates, you know, uncontested threes for the most part against a really good, you know, Houston defense. So that was huge. And then watching their game against Memphis tonight, I mean, Kendrick Davis was fantastic for Memphis in that game. He had 30 points, 5 assists, and 4 steals. And, you know, like just looking at our team, like we could really use one of those guys, right? Just
you think we could use Kendrick Davis? You know? Although, I mean, he got hurt at the end of the game, right? So
yeah, he did.
Hopefully he's going to be okay. Do you think we could use Kendrick Davis and DeAndre Williams? I would take those maybe a little bit. And how about just the kind of the, you know, what we've seen going on with Quinterly here, a guy who, you know, was years ago just a huge recruit from Villanova, finally kind of found his footing with Bama last year, and now he's coming back for senior year. He's seeing his minutes reduced. He's basically kind of gotten supplanted by Sears and Jaden Bradley.
Yeah, tough business, right?
I mean, it is tough, especially. So where are you? Okay, who's going to win? Who do you think? We'll leave with this. And I guess you can ask your question that you always ask. Who is going to win the SEC regular season?
Wow. Okay. That's a tough one.
We should also say that Arkansas just lost Brazil for the season with a knee injury.
Right. Right. I'll go with Alabama just because I don't trust Tennessee's offense in tight games.
Yeah. I like Alabama, but I'm going to go with Arkansas. I just made that decision on the spot. I love both teams. I like Tennessee too. I just think that they're not quite as athletic as the other two teams, and then Kentucky is big.
Yeah, you're a big Ricky Council guy too.
I love Council. I think he's dynamite. I'm not impressed at all with Kentucky at all. You know, who knows, maybe they'll get their stuff together. But okay, do you want to ask your your kind of always asked question before we
of course. So we're talking about who the third best team in the Pac-12 is, and I think we're on the same page here with ASU.
Now it should be said that if you were to ask that question to KenPom, he'd say it's very, very close call between ASU, Oregon, and Utah, interestingly enough. Until Oregon gets their guards back, I'm going to go with ASU, which is a team that truly, truly has benefited from addition by subtraction. They gotten better with Marcus Bagley not playing, and the Cambridge brothers basically playing together at the three of the four. That's been kind of what's gotten them going. And, you know, that's nice that you get to play with your brother.
Yeah, that's cool. One note on Utah, I think they're a little bit fraudulent just looking at their statistical profile. So they are sixth in two-point defense and fifth in three-point defense, which is pretty much unheard of, especially given their like lack of athleticism and length compared to, you know, elite defensive teams of the past. So I think a lot of, especially the 3-point defense, is luck. I mean, if you're packing it in, you know, to get that sixth ranked 2-point defense, you know, they're just fortunate that a lot of their opponents are missing threes. And then conversely, their offense, they're 26th in 3-point percentage. So, you know, the 3-point profile, like them shooting 39.1% and their opponent shooting 25.4%, that's not going to last. I think they'll mean regress there. They're also 40th in free throw defense too. So I know they have good crowds at the Huntsman Center, but I'm not really buying. I don't think they're a top 20 defense, especially just given that they don't create a lot of turnovers, I guess.
Yeah, they got to prove itself to me. Okay. Game tomorrow night. And till then, I guess we'll do one more pod before the holidays. So everyone fight on.
Yeah, fight on.